Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Anthony M. Amore, Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And we're talking about his latest book, The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rustboro House Art Heist. Anthony, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's my pleasure to do the same.
This is a fascinating story, and it was unexpected to me because it ended up being really the account of a spectacular art heist, but also it's the biography of a woman who was born into wealth and influence and how she evolved into a violent radical, and that's a really wild story.
It is, and I'm glad you caught it. It's an interesting thing because, in truth, the title of the book is probably more aptly titled Rose Dugdale, Her Life and Times, but nobody knew who Rose Dugdale was. So it's the title is centered around her most notorious accomplishment, which is this massive, largest of its day art heist that she pulled off. But as you put, and I thank you for it, it's much more remarkable than just that.
Well, and by the way, it's also a classic comic illustrated or Cliff Notes history of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And you know, I'm of the age that I lived through that time, and I remember it while I was in college. I think most people today know nothing about that history of what went on in Northern Ireland, too.
I think that's correct, and I think it's unfortunate. And I think also, getting a bit off track, even Brexit might lead to a resurgence of some of this.
I know
that it's such an unbelievable story. And here in New England, with a large Irish population, especially where I am in Boston, you know that there are a lot of people who remember it, but the memories of it are fading. And for people like you and me, it is something that we live through and understand.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it brought back all these important headlines that I read at the time, and I was following that story because of his Irish descent.
The interesting thing is I'll always remember there was a major news story just before 9/11 hit of these Catholic students that were going to school, and a bunch of Protestant people were throwing rocks and bottles at them, and this was late as then, and it was a very worrisome thing about maybe there was going to be a resurgence. And then 9/11 happened, and it just overwhelms all the news cycles, and we never heard about it again.
Now, the time period we're talking about is mostly around the mid-70s, 1970s?
Late 60s to the mid-70s, yes.
Now, the news story that you heard in Britain was really about this girl who was so awful she rebelled against her wonderful parents, and she was born, and we'll talk about her background in just a bit. But this was really an important age, as you write in your book, of conflict and liberation movements. And Rose was influenced not just by what was going on in Ireland, but in liberation movements around the world.
Without a doubt. And one of the most important experiences that she had at this time was in 1968, when she went with a group of students. And it's notable to mention that she was about 6 years older than the students who went. She was actually an academic by her when she was 27 or 28. So when she went, she was with people that were younger than her. And, you know, again, when you're our age, six-year age difference is nothing. But when you're 28, 22-year-olds are much younger. But she went, and, you know, it's a big difference.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had friends who made the trip to Cuba.
Oh, interesting. That's very interesting. And it was more of elite-type students and those with means who could go. I mean, one of the people I point out is Christopher Hitchens went.
And that's right.
That's how I knew about the 1968 camps, the Cinco de Mayo camps. I had read in his autobiography before I researched Rose. So there, it's a fascinating thing.
Now, she was always incredibly earnest in her revolutionary activism. And she's still alive, right?
She is. She just turned 80. Late in March.
She was always about freeing Northern Ireland, and especially, we'll talk about the sisters, and about the end of capitalism. But how did the other established Irish radicals treat her? I mean, people like in Sinn Féin and the IRA and the other groups, she was sort of on the edge. She was not considered part of them, was she?
No, and that's a great point. I'm glad you caught that, because it's one of the things that led me to write the book, is I had often heard that she was an IRA soldier who stole these paintings, and that never sat right with me. And in my research, I found she was never really accepted. And when she was younger, the IRA and Sinn Féin and just the people of Northern Ireland looked at her with a skeptical eye. They wondered if this was a poor little rich girl who was just having fun, learning about life by taking on their fight. And interestingly, by now, at age 80, Rose is completely embraced by Sinn Féin and the people of Northern Ireland. They see, she stayed in Dublin and she gave up all her riches. And, the test of time is one that she passed.
Is she as radical as ever?
She sure is. I mean, I have a photo of her signing the condolence book for Fidel Castro when he died, and a photo of her with a rifle in her wheelchair at a parade and marching alongside Jerry Adams. So, yeah, she never lost her zeal.
Now, a lot of people, when they first hear this story, they're going to make, if you're of a certain age, you're going to make a comparison to Patty Hearst. And as you point out in the book, that's not a good comparison.
No, and it's that surface level understanding again that drove me to write the book, where Patty Hearst was kidnapped into what she was doing, and then she continued to do it because she fell in love with the leader of the SLA, and they used her not as an advertisement, but as a propaganda. And when she was arrested, she fought her prosecution. And Rose is the exact opposite of this. She dove headfirst into the fight for Irish republicanism. She was behind the scenes. The IRA didn't promote her. And when she was prosecuted, she famously pled proudly and incorruptibly guilty.
She's an amazing person. I mean, I really thank you for reading this book. She comes out as sort of a wild, true believer. I mean, she was nobody's, as you write in your book, nobody's accomplice. I mean, she was her own person.
It's so true, Mark. One of the things that strikes me is it's really a story of its time, because media in the early 1970s, when they were trying to dissect what she had done and why she had done it, all fell into the opinion, including the judge in her case, that she must have been under the influence of a man.
Right.
Even a woman doing this on her own fruition. And the fact is, and I've spoken to Walter Heaton at length, they fell under her sway. She was the leader. She was someone that could not be comprehended in her time.
Not only did she steal 19 paintings, okay, and 19 important paintings in 1974, the largest art heist at the time, she was history's first and only female mastermind of a theft of a high-value, recognizable masterpieces. But she also masterminded an aerial assault on a police station.
Right. It's just a remarkable thing where she came up with this idea with her new lover, Eddie Gallagher, that they would hijack a helicopter and they made their own explosives and tried to drop them on a Royal Ulster Constabulary, and they were off mark. And the interesting thing is, in interviews, the police leadership kind of laughed and said they chuckled at their ineptitude. But the fact is that nobody was really laughing at this. This would have been a mass murder if it had succeeded. Untold number of people would have been killed in these bombings. It would be something that people would still be talking about. And it just happened to miss its mark, but it really set the police on her tail.
Now, when people hear about art heists, and I'm one of them, especially of highly recognizable masterpieces, you have to wonder, why are they stealing these? Here in Worcester, we had a theft at the Worcester Art Museum. Where you work at the Isabella Stewart Gardner, you had a art heist. You can't do anything with the paintings. I mean, you can't just sell them because, they're well-known and well-recognized. Why was she stealing the artworks?
Well, you make a great point. And, in my first book I wrote, the first chapter was about the Worcester art heist. And,
yeah. Friends of mine were in the building at the time and were ended up lying on the floor.
Yeah, I don't blame them. And that was a scary scene. And that was it's a great illustration of how you can't sell these stolen masterpieces.
You're sort of stuck with them afterwards unless you have some kind of rich private person who can afford them.
Right, and that never happens, never. And Al Mundy, who was the mastermind of that heist, was sure he could sell them. Now, Rose is a whole different category because she believed that she would use them to try to free some political prisoners, which makes her an outlier. Money was never her goal.
Never.
She had no intention of trying to monetize these. She wanted to use them in a ransom deal.
So she was brilliant all around. I mean, you can't deny the fact that she was brilliant in what she was planning.
She was brilliant. She was rash. She was bold. She was far ahead of her time. And it's just a remarkable outlier. And I'm really fascinated by people who are outliers like her.
Let's start with her childhood and her upbringing. She was born March 25th, 1941, as Bridget Rose Dugdale. Talk to me about the life she was born into.
The most idyllic life you can imagine, the rolling hills on Yardie Farm, her family's estate in Devon, never wanting for a thing, a life of luxury, of servants, of the finest schools, of every advantage a child could ever want. And this is can't be overstated, but this is what she was willing to give up.
There's some amazing things. Was she presented to Queen Elizabeth II?
She was. Great point. She was at the last group of debutantes to go before the Queen in 1958, and she was reluctant. She didn't want to do it.
Oh, she hated the whole process. She thought it was pornographic.
Yep, a meat market, she thought of it as. And an amazing thing, again, something you can't imagine now in life. The reason she went through it was her parents agreed grudgingly to let her attend Oxford. And, I mean, I have two college-age daughters, and I would be quite pleased if they wanted to go to Oxford. I wouldn't need to make a deal with them to let them go, but that was the early 70s, late 60s.
Now, she goes to Oxford, and as you write about it, even then she started to show signs of sort of this real rebelliousness.
She does, and her fellow students remember that she's still a capitalist at the time, but she does something remarkable. She and a friend note that women are not allowed in the Oxford Union. So they dress up as men, rather convincingly, and go to the Oxford Union where they study, and they're not caught right away. And it makes the news. It's a sensation that these two women penetrated this bastion of exclusivity. And it's really a really cool thing. And they knew they were doing something momentous because they had themselves photographed as they were being prepped and dressed as men for their big moment.
Now, pretty early on, she takes to the ideology of the Black Power movement, which for people, again, who are not old enough to remember, was a very big thing at that time. We have a sort of a different political landscape now, but then that was a really considered a radical movement.
Oh, without a doubt. And she and her lover, Wally Heaton, both were students of the Black Panthers. And most importantly, noted that what the Black Panthers would do when they were prosecuted is use the courtroom as their bully pulpit.
Right,
so
right.
They would not pass up an opportunity to give long political speeches, and it was effective. And Rose and Wally both did that throughout their lives. Every time they had a chance to give their side in the courtroom, they weren't pleading for innocence. They were pleading their political motives.
Now, there's just a couple of odds and ends that I want to talk about. One of them, and you refer to this every once in a while in the book, she did have an upbringing from the great side of the tracks. So she had what you call a posh accent. So it was so weird for this radical to be talking in that accent.
Right. And when she was on the run for a time, it was difficult for her because, you know, they would go to these Republican sympathizer safe houses, and she would be looked at skeptically because that's who she was. She had this posh accent. She was well known. She had already made headlines around the world when she had done an art theft from her parents' home. And so people knew who she was, and they knew she was an Oxford educated PhD. So she really was such a It's funny, at one time, even at Mount Holyoke.
Yeah, that's right. She spent time right here in Massachusetts.
Of course. There's always a Massachusetts connection to Crazy Heart Heights. And she, one friend called her a weird orchid amongst the daisies, and that's how she has always been.
Now, and to make it clear, she was never a Trotskyist or a Marxist. I mean, she hated those people.
Right, and it's an interesting thing because you can't really pin her down to one specific ideology. The easiest way to describe her is just an anti-capitalist.
Yeah, exactly.
She doesn't have a label.
Now, as she's proceeding on, and you trace her growing political awareness really, really well in this book, and people are going to really have to read it. We're just giving you the cliff notes of this. She was hired to the Economics Directorate of the Ministry of Overseas Development. So the weird thing is she's becoming radical, but she's still in the system sometimes. But you also mentioned that the years there that she spent there were crucial to her metamorphosis. Why? From academic to activist.
Right. I think it's because she got a chance to be exposed to conditions around the world that she suspected to be true, but now she got to see it in writing and in person through her work with the UN. But you make a great point. The only time she was really gainfully employed was working as an academic, where she was spending much of her time at sit-ins and identifying with the students more than the faculty, but then also working for the establishment, as you mentioned. But in an odd way, that work for the establishment helped to radicalize her.
Well, you mentioned books, and I can remember reading these at the time. Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, which was sort of like, if you were any kind of leftist person, and I was, and I am, at that time, you read that book. That was crucial to her, too. And there was the classic readings of those late 60s authors that helped radicalize her.
Yeah, and you know, it's an interesting thing about the books is if you look at when she is in prison, one of the pleas is for her to have access to books because her mind is so lively. And then the authorities have sent I think it was Iris Murdoch who sent it, this belief that her mind is so active, she can't be limited to the books, the pedestrian books that are in a prison library.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Anthony M. Amore, Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And we're talking about his latest book. It's a fascinating read and a great history of the time. The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Roseborough House Art Heist. Now, at Bedford, her field of study is proper names, their role in objects, which sounds like the dullest thing in the world.
I've read a bunch of it, and it is.
What is that?
It was hard for me to get my mind around it, but it's really indicative of her because Rose would take on the hardest, most dense and arcane type study. And that's an example of it. And you would read it and wonder where is she going with this? What rabbit hole is she going down? It's really something that it's morphine on paper is the best way I can describe it.
Now, she ends up being in Paris at the time of the riots there. She was a soixante huitade.
She is in. One of the funny things about her, she seems to be in these different places at the right time.
Like she travels to Cuba, she goes to Paris at the time of the riots.
Right, and when she's in Germany as a student, she's staying at the former home of Hermann Göring. Just a really interesting life. She's almost has this Zelig-like.
Yeah.
You know, because all of her. You know, her most notable period takes place in a very, very short time period. Again, it's between 68 and 74 that she does that she sort of comes of age and then commits these crimes. But one of the interesting things about her, and I write about it in the book, is even after she goes to prison for the art heist, the apex of her criminality, she stays in the news through really strange connections to her popularity, I guess.
Now, the scene switches to Belfast and the struggles and Bloody Sunday. For people, if I can ask you just to describe what happened on Bloody Sunday, because it's one of those things. I think literally most people know it as a song from a rock group, unfortunately. But that was a big event at that point in time, especially in the relationship between Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and you know, when you and I spoke earlier about the way that, about the Troubles and what we remember of them, but it's important for people to remember that the Irish Republican movement had just had a rebirth in around 68 and 69.
Right,
so essentially
exactly.
When Rose comes back from Cuba, again, perfect timing, there's this rebirth. And one of the interesting things that I hadn't known was that the way that the movement was reborn was really following Dr. King's example of nonviolent protest. So and even the Price sisters, you know, these famous IRA soldiers, started off as, you know, peaceful marchers, thinking that this was the way, this is how it could be done. But then a series of marches were met with violence from loyalists, including the police. And these Irish rebels, as they would become, saw that their peaceful attempts would not work, that no matter what they did, they were going to be beaten. And with the complicity, not just the blind eye, but the complicity of the police. So it all culminates with Bloody Sunday, when peaceful marchers are having a large-scale protest, but then 13 of them are shot in no better term than murdered by paratroopers, British troops. And these are innocent, defenseless people who are slaughtered in the streets. And that really, more than any other single event, changed the way the IRA would wage their own war, structured as a military force, again, like in the teens and 20s, and ready to use violence to get their way.
And that also contributed to Rose's violent radicalization, too, to go from just being radical and sort of spouting and supporting causes to being actively involved in violence. And you talked about the Price sisters. We need to talk about them, Marion and Dolores. They're young. They're teenagers.
Kids. You're right. They're kids. I mean, they're 20 and 18.
And one of the things that I never knew details about, and you include it in the book, is they went on hunger strikes and they were force-fed. And a lot of people hearing this, like, well, force-fed, you know, they were just sort of given food. Force-feeding is incredibly traumatic and frightening to be on the other end of it. It is really, really a horrible thing to do to a person.
Such an important point. You know, I thought the same thing before I really researched what force-feeding is, because you hear, you know, when you got your own life going on and you watch the news and you try to stay current, you hear someone's on a hunger strike and they're force-fed, you kind of think, well, it doesn't sound pretty, but, you know, at least they'll get some nutrition, and you write it off. But
force-feeding
was worse than the hunger strike, and it led to horrible infections. That's what ultimately led to Dolores Price having PTSD from the experience, was the force-feeding. You have to picture this method where they're putting this block into your mouth with a hole in it to keep your mouth open and then putting a tube through this block and scraping your esophagus and getting infections and just pumping this vile soup of nutrients into your stomach, and most of it you're going to regurgitate. And it's just horrifying. It seems like torture, and for them it was.
And it was there specifically, it was for the sisters that Rose became radicalized, who decided to take direct action with violence when necessary.
Yes, absolutely. And it was the fact that, you know, unfortunate for the Price sisters, but they were the perfect, the perfect propaganda for the IRA movement. Not that they were being used that way, but because they were young and pretty, waifish girls being force-fed, it just led to headlines around the world. The whole world knew about what was happening to the Price sisters. And they weren't asking to be released. They were asking to be moved to a prison in Northern Ireland.
That's right.
As was the custom. They weren't, you know, this wasn't a protest saying we're innocent, we should be released. They wanted to be moved as political prisoners. And it was a real quandary for the British government as well. And I would hate to be one of the decision makers for the government at the time, because, you know, not defending the British government, but from their point of view, these are two women that set off car bombs, four car bombs around the city. And notice that we're talking about the Price sisters. There were men with them, but it's the Price sisters we remember because of who they were and what they looked like and
right.
what they represented. I mean, these two young, very young, beautiful girls in the early 1970s, that's what they were described as. And here they are fighting for their cause. That really adds some credibility to the Irish argument.
Now, we're almost completely out of time, and I wanted to not give a lot of details about the art heist so people will buy your book, because I don't want to just, because there's a lot of stuff that goes on. And not only that, there's her romances, too, which are pretty wild. But I just want to mention at the end, you think it's possible that she was actually involved in another art heist? Just say yes or no.
I do, and I hope people read my argument.
It sounded pretty solid to me.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, in fact, that could be Vermeer's?
Imagine that, having stolen two Vermeer's. That's just mind-boggling.
You got to read the book. My guest tonight is Anthony M. Amore, Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And we're talking about his latest book. It is a tremendous biography, as well as a history of the time and a great sort of action whodunit and how it was solved. A great art heist book, The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Roseborough House Art Heist. Anthony, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
It's been mine. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.